Hidden Gems, Episode 54, Designer Spotlight on Marcel André Casasola Merkel. Welcome to Hidden Gems, a board game podcast where we review unusual, forgotten, and underappreciated board games. We're your hosts. My name is Chris.
I'm Jason.
And this is Bill.
Welcome to the show.
How'd you like that name reading?
Say that 10 times fast.
was that five names in this
I
name?
Nailed that.
That was really good.
I noticed you pause after every word. Make sure you said it right.
We got to stay professional here on Hidden Gems. Got to make it sound good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're leading us off.
Because I'm definitely the most professional. Three Amigos back again. Unfortunately, no Cameron this time.
Yeah. I feel like I went through the ringer of not being able to be here for stuff house-related and whatnot. And I feel like the plague has stricken Cameron now.
Ugh.
Oh, he's on baby watch. He gets an out.
Well, he's got that. Yeah, for sure.
Well, they got all of us because my house was a blazing inferno about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that's right.
And now a tree fell on Cameron's house.
My house is a blazing inferno now, too. But only the upstairs, so it's okay.
Are you guys sleeping downstairs or are you just toughing it out?
My bedroom's downstairs, so it doesn't affect me. But
just the kids.
Two of my kids are sweating through the night.
Oh, that's hysterical. No,
they sleep downstairs.
Okay.
We're not evil or anything. I mean,
well, in case you're clenching your teeth and you're wondering if Cameron is okay, we just said that a tree fell on his house. He is okay.
He is okay.
We had a crazy storm here, like four weeks ago.
Mainly in Durham, though, too. Yes. Like, it hit his area a lot worse than it hit ours.
Yeah.
I remember we got a wicked storm. It was like thunderstorm, but it wasn't too bad. And then when I was driving to work, I work at Duke University, I got rerouted. And I was like, what is going on? Why am I getting rerouted? And there were downed trees. And I'm talking huge trees all over the place in Durham. I guess we had had some sort of tornado or something. And a tree fell on Cameron's house.
Wow. Yeah.
Luckily, he's okay, and they're getting it fixed. But that's kind of taking him out of the cycle here for a little bit longer.
Put a nice little hole through the roof.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's funny. I have a wooded acre lot and have some 30, 40-year-old pine trees that are 60, 70 feet tall.
Huge ones.
Huge pine trees on my lot. And so I just yesterday had 14 of those trees taken out.
But that cost a pretty penny.
It cost quite a lot. That little tractor's out, and my lawn looks like a mess because they've torn that up. But I had two trees in my backyard that were leaning, I bet, conservatively, I don't know, 8 degrees off of a vertical, and they were leaning towards the house.
Yeah.
And I had the people scheduled to come out before that storm. No, excuse me, like 2 days after that storm. And it just put me off because of the Durham houses that were hit. They had a whole bunch of emergency situations where they had to clear stuff off. And so this was the earliest they could get there. And that's been, what, 2 weeks ago?
Something like that.
It's been a long time.
I know what that's like. I don't know if I've talked about it on the show before, but we had that happen. It was right before COVID, I think. I was leaving to drive to our board game weekend for that year.
Yeah.
And I had to turn around. I got like 30 minutes down the road, and I had to stop and turn around because my wife called me and she, like, freaking out. The kids were freaking out because a tree fell on our house. Luckily, it didn't put a hole in our house, but it was still quite an ordeal to take care of, dealing with insurance companies and all that stuff.
All right. Well, it was pretty fun. Yeah, I got a lot of pictures.
I was going to say, in typical Bill fashion, he sent me like three videos of him videoing these guys working.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have videos of it, too. It's wild. They get up there on these ropes, and they're hanging up there.
That has to be one of the most dangerous jobs in the country. Yeah. I mean, I was in awe.
Right.
Because they're up there handling this thing with a spinning blade on it. Right. Huge limbs falling off. I mean, that was incredible.
Right.
What they do.
They're dropping it off, and then the thing swings back and forth, you know, by 10 feet. You know, the whole tree slow, you know, rocking back and forth because it just lost, you know, 500 pounds off its top kind of thing. It was crazy. And being inside, I could feel it when they were dropping these trunks. It would just shake the earth with the thump as they hit the ground. It's just crazy to watch it all.
Nice.
I guess we're talking about our lives now,
aren't we? We are talking about our lives.
Let's see. The other thing I'll talk about, that was pretty impactful since the last time we talked. But
that's better than a roadside peach.
It is. I will say that Jason had an event in the last couple of weeks where he turned a multiple of 10 in his age. I won't say which one because I was just telling Chris I thought he turned...
The baby in here.
That's right. He turned 50 last
time. The baby. I guess I am the baby.
You totally are. You're younger than us.
Oh, yeah. But as part of his birthday
younger
party...
Younger than you by like 6 months.
Yeah, I guess.
That's funny. As part of his birthday party, he had invited us to go tubing, and I'll let Jason talk about that. But I didn't realize this. At the beginning of my summer, my daughter asked me to go tubing, and I had said, "Nah, I'm not going to go." And then when I told her I'm going tubing with Jason, she's like, "What the hell? I mean, what the heck, Dad? What's up with that?" And so, like, the weekend after Jason's tubing, I ended up taking my daughter and her boyfriend out, and we went tubing down the same stretch, the same 4 hours. That's a long
four hours drift.
It's a long stretch of river.
It's a good 4 hours, though.
I would be completely baked. I don't know how you survived it, Jason. I mean, you're white as a sheet.
A lot of it's shaded, to be honest.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Yeah, good part of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but we had a blast. She loved it. It's like, "Dad, why didn't you do this growing up with me?" It's like,
did you go on the tree swing this time?
What's that?
Did you go on the tree swing?
I didn't, but her boyfriend did, and he did a good job on it. So.
Nice. Well, yeah. So, as Bill alluded to, I turned 40.
Yeah.
What was that, a week ago? 2 weeks ago? Just scary. I had to go to the doctor because I've been sick like the past week, and they gave me the, "Well, you're over 40 now" speech. And I was like, oh no. Your
colonoscopy is going to be coming up soon.
I don't think that's 40. I think
it's 45, actually.
Okay, good. It's good to know. But yeah, tubing was a lot of fun. We had a good number of people out there. I think we had 18 people out on the river.
Oh, wow. Something like that. It looked like a bunch. Yeah, it was crazy.
So the Neuse River is the, everybody who's listening is probably like, "What river are they talking about? There's no rivers in Raleigh." And there aren't really, but the Neuse River runs through Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
Actually runs all the way out to the ocean. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was fun. What was funny to me is I didn't have a tube. And, you know, Chris and I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina, which is a totally different experience of tubing than what we had. So I went online and I bought it like a tractor tire tube, right? It is the hard rubber tire, expecting, you know, I'm going to be hitting rocks and, you know, scraping the bottom and all this other stuff. And I was going to have
if you're not hitting your butt against a rock.
Exactly. I mean. And then with that rough rubber, every single person, all other 17 people, if there was 18 people out there, had these pool tubes.
Yeah, right? These pink tubes.
Exactly.
No. They were actual river rafting tubes.
Okay. But, you say so.
So they're slightly more durable than a pool floaty. But
that's probably.
They're not tractor tires either.
But they're wide.
They have backrests. That's the best part.
That's true. And cup holders, which I was really jealous about.
We had a beer cooler float.
Mm-hmm. We were outfitted. But when you try to steer and move around with those things that you had versus a tractor tire, you can't get your arms underwater, right? When you stretch your arms out, you can get like your hands in, and you look like a spastic penguin or something when you're trying to paddle, because all you can do is like scoop your hands in a little awkward manner. But with a real tube,
you're trying to paddle, you're missing the point, Bill.
Hey, you had to thread the needle a couple times. Well, I was expecting a much rougher river, and it was like a long, skinny lake all the way down. I will tell you that. It is not a mountain river, Chris. So.
Yeah. The Neuse is very chill, but it was fun. We had a good time.
It was good.
What have you been up to, Chris?
All right, well, if you know me, I'm usually going to talk about one of three things.
Mm-hmm.
Video games, graphic novels, or a TV show that I've been watching lately. I haven't talked about TV shows in a while because there really hasn't been a lot of good ones, but I'm going to talk about a show today. It's not really a hidden gem type of show at all, but this show just released a new season, probably in the last few months. It's probably been in the last 6 months or so. A TV series that I really, really enjoy. I used to enjoy a lot more. I feel like the more recent seasons tailed off, and now it got really good again. And that's Black Mirror.
Mm. I thought that's what you were going to say.
Yeah. Have you watched the most recent season yet?
Yes.
You both have?
I have.
So you can chime in here then.
I watched the Lock Henry.
Lock Henry, because I recommended it.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. All right. Save that thought. So if you don't know what Black Mirror is, Black Mirror is a TV show. It's a series of like short stories. They're self-contained episodes. One episode isn't related to the other necessarily, although there is a little bit of wink-wink crossover between some episodes that suggests that maybe they're in the same universe at times, but they're really not related at all. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the idea behind Black Mirror is they're dark takes on technology. Some aspect of technology and the way that it could be misused or something bad could come out of it. And it never ceases to amaze me how this show always comes up with new ideas for this, of just creative things in that kind of vein. I'm going to attempt to do a short list.
Okay.
I haven't done this in a while.
Uh-huh.
It's gonna be a,
I don't know.
I know. The Chris Alley top five.
Of Black Mirrors?
My most favorite Black Mirror episodes.
Okay.
Only five. I'll be fast. One of the things I do think is interesting about this, I actually Googled this and looked this up. If you look up top Black Mirror episodes, everybody's list is completely different.
That's crazy.
Somebody's worst, you'll go to the next list and it'll be like in their top five.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very subjective in that way, which I think is what makes it interesting, right? It's all mm-hmm. kind of what's interesting to you.
I'll be happy to tell you when you're wrong, though, because okay. I'm feeling that you're absolutely wrong.
It's probably like which ones tap into your fears the most.
That's what
they're really about. Yeah.
Yeah, so this list mostly is, if you've not watched Black Mirror, to kind of get you intrigued. And maybe if you want to check it out, check it out.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend you start with these five, and I'll go ahead and spoil and say that National Anthem, the episode one of season one, is not on here.
That one is rough.
Yeah. Do not start with that one.
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very rough.
It goes to a super dark place super fast, and I have no doubt that most people never finished it because they're like, this is too much for me.
Right.
Now, I know I probably got a lot of people to watch it just based on that.
True.
But I wouldn't recommend you start there.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do think the episode is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So number five is from season one. It's called The Entire History of You. So the idea behind this episode is that everybody in this world has something called a grain that's inserted behind their ear.
Oh, right. It records everything.
Yeah, and it connects to their central nervous system somehow, to where everything that they see through their point of view is basically recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually have like a remote where they can go backwards through their timeline, and people can see what they were doing, who they were with, where they were. Pretty much everything is on file. Mm-hmm. And you can just imagine how that could go horribly wrong.
Right.
Right. But yep. I found the story to be, I would say this was probably the first episode where I was like, whoa, this show is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I just really liked the idea of it.
Right.
So that would be my number five. You guys like that one?
That was a good one. Really good one. The whole idea that somebody could ask to see your feed.
Yes.
You know, your wife's going to say, okay, hey, I want to see what you were doing last Thursday night.
Where were you really? Yeah.
Or like rewinding an argument.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's part of that.
It is. Yeah. Like what an actual account of what happened was and how you can hold that over people and things. Yeah. Interesting.
How like our built-in forgetfulness is actually a gift in a way.
It's true.
Like honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That should be a pub theology discussion.
I'll write that down for next week.
It's a lot easier to keep a record of wrongs in this world of Black Mirror. That's for sure. All right, number four. This is a controversial one. A lot of people hate this one, but I thought it was just super cool, and that's White Bear. So White Bear is an episode where a woman is sitting in a chair. She wakes up in a room surrounded by pills on the ground. She has no idea how she got there or why she's there. She's got amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
And she ventures out to try to figure out what's going on because she really has no clue why she's there. And people are recording her with their phones. People are staring at her through the windows, and she tries to interact with them, and they run from her. And then she starts getting chased by this guy with a shotgun who's trying to kill her for some reason.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'll say about it. But the whole time you're trying to figure out, like, what the heck is going on here? It's a weird one.
I do remember this one now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Your list has made me remember something that I should talk about after this. Remind me.
Really?
Yeah.
Now I'm intrigued.
I just finished a book today, actually, that is Black Mirror-ish.
Okay.
So
maybe if we got time, we could talk about it.
Yeah, we'll chat about
it. Okay, all right. Number three. This is from the newest season. This is from season six, and this one's called Beyond the Sea. This one stars Josh Hartnett and Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad.
Mm.
So the idea behind this one is that manned space travel into deep space is kind of impossible, right? Because the number of years it would take to get past Mars or whatever is just unrealistic for people to endure that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea in this episode is that these two astronauts sit in this chair in their spacecraft and they're able to cerebrally connect with something called a receptacle, which is basically an android of them in the real life where they can interact with their families so that it makes the trip bearable, basically. So that it's like they're back home when they're in the receptacle, but then they enter back into the spaceship to do their logistical things.
It's like the peripheral.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so just think about that premise and how that could go wrong
mm-hmm.
is basically the idea. And I will say one more thing about this episode. I love it when shows make you think it's going somewhere and it doesn't. And this one does that multiple times or several times. I'm like, oh, okay, this is going to happen. And it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It just kept me on my toes the whole time.
Very cool.
It was good. All right, number two. This one is from season two, and it's White Christmas. This one stars John Hamm from, what was he in? Mad Men.
Mad Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's in Good Home.
Fantastic
too.
Show, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I tried to watch Mad Men. I got so bored.
Maybe I need to try it again. Slow burn. It takes a while, but it's very well done and how it approaches various issues of dynamics between men and women and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting show.
He's a fantastic actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you seen Good Omens? I think he's the guy in Good Omens now. So. Oh, wow. That's Neil Gaiman, right? His is the TV
show. Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, my gosh. You got to watch this new season anyway. Go
ahead. Add it to the list. All right, so the idea behind White Christmas is two guys are in a cabin in a snowstorm, John Hamm and this other guy, and it looks like they're roommates, they're living together, but they're talking as if they don't really know each other very well. Mm-hmm. And so the John Hamm character is talking to this other guy, telling him about things he did in his past life and all this technology that he developed and just trying to get this other guy to open up and talk to him, basically. And the whole time you're trying to figure out, like, whoa... This is kind of a common thing in Black Mirror. You're like, what is going on here? Why are these guys together? Why does this guy not know this other guy, really? It's weird. And then it's all like constantly flashbacking to John Hamm's past life and things he used to do. And then it all just comes together in a really neat way, I think. Y'all seen this one?
I can't remember it.
I've only seen parts of the first season and the one episode that I watched of the most recent one.
Okay,
so.
All right.
I need to watch some more of it, though.
White Christmas is worth watching. It's so neat.
I'm drawing a blank on it. I don't know why, but...
Yeah, like that one. And then number one, Jason's already alluded to it already. This is the episode that made me do this banter section because I just thought it was so good. And that's Locke Henry from season six. This storytelling
it's
in this...
It's a pretty twisted episode, too,
to be honest. Super dark. Mm. And... The one thing I'll say about this one is it's just a masterclass in storytelling because I rewatched it the second time. Little things that they do in this episode that you think are just throwaway and not important, everything that is said, everything that is shown matters. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like it should. It's so innocuous in that way. The show just totally caught me off guard. It's just so clever, I thought
the episode was really good. It actually gave me... Have you watched any of Jordan Peele's movies?
So... I downloaded Nope to watch it, and I haven't watched it yet.
Don't start with that.
Or wait, no, it's not Nope. It's, what's the one with the sky?
That's Nope.
Okay,
with the alien ship or something.
Stuff's falling from the sky.
I haven't watched that one. I wouldn't start with that, though. But this episode gave me very, very strong Jordan Peele vibes. If you ever watched Get Out.
Okay.
Because I feel like there is some racial tension stuff going on.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
In this episode, and that is, like, very similar. If you liked this episode... I mean, not just for that aspect of it, but like for just the way that it's filmed and the tension that's all throughout it. Watch at least Get Out. And what's the one with the people dressed up in red with the masks on? I can't remember the name of the second one, but yeah.
I'll have to check them out.
I think you would like them.
Yeah, admittedly, I haven't seen any of them. But yeah, Locke Henry's awesome. I guess I didn't get the premise real quickly. So this guy and his girlfriend go back to his hometown to do a documentary. So this is kind of a take on these true life documentaries that have been real popular lately.
Right.
They were going to do some Lane documentary on some birds or something.
Right.
And they decide to actually do a documentary on a serial killer who actually killed people in Locke Henry, which affected their tourism and stuff like that. And his girlfriend's like, oh, this will be way more cool. Let's do this. And he's like, I don't know. You know, it kind of affected my family and I'm not really into that. But he agrees. Mm-hmm. And so they go down this path, basically, of figuring out what happened back then. And it is just really good storytelling, in my opinion. I just love it.
I agree. Well, and the
acting. Did you watch it?
Oh, yeah, I watched it. Yeah, yeah. Because the acting and the way they represented people, it almost feels like it's not like you're bored with it, but they're so real, right?
Yes.
It's like you're watching, this is how real people would act in this situation.
Totally.
And the way it all comes together is just, it is really good.
Yeah, it's like school friend barkeeper guy. Mm-hmm. I thought was super well acted. You know what I mean?
It's good cinematography too. They're in a really beautiful part of the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Good stuff. So yeah.
So the only one I would add to this list. And
let's hear it.
Is the, don't know the names, but the Choose Your Own Adventure one.
Oh, Bandersnatch.
Bandersnatch. Yeah. You didn't like that one?
Oh, I did watch that one.
Yeah, it's cool.
I mean, just through the technology of it and the fact that you could do it at home. I just thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Any honorable mentions, Jason?
You know, it's been a very long time. I mean, the first season came out, what?
It's been years.
Seven or 8 years ago, probably, at this point. So I watched a good portion of that and then just never really carried on with it. But you're making me want to go back and watch more of it.
Yeah, you should, man. I've got a couple. I'm not going to talk about them, but again, National Anthem, if you like those first five, watch that after you watch the first five. Shut Up and Dance, which is also super dark. Don't start with that one. USS Callister and Metalhead, actually, which there's actually no talking in Metalhead at all. No dialogue.
What's the one
super
with,
cool?
That's basically the Facebook likes and dislikes on everybody that you
meet.
Yeah,
so that's the one with Bryce Dallas Howard, Ron Howard's daughter.
Oh, okay.
Where she's like obsessed with getting likes.
Well, just everybody in the world is.
Yes, yeah. How that backfires on her.
Yes. Well, to me, I thought it was just a great representation of our world right now, as far as at least maybe there's pressure in our teenagers' lives, and maybe, I don't know, I will say girls because I had two girls and I'm more sensitive to it, but to be liked and be liked in a social community. And this is like amps that up to a dystopian future where everybody, it's almost like a currency, how much you're being liked in the world, kind of thing.
It's like equals to your worth as a person, basically.
Exactly. How many stars you get in every interaction. And to me, I thought it was just super fascinating.
Yeah.
So real quick, I'll just throw out.
Do it.
I just finished this book by Blake Crouch called Dark Matter. I'm trying to figure out how much of the plot to explain or not. But basically,
Mr. Jason doesn't want to give it away.
Yeah, I mean, you gave away plot points in some of those episodes.
So. I'm sure I did. You got to give him a hook, you know?
So basically, it's about this guy who is a physics professor at a local like community college. And he goes out one night. He's like married and has a son who's in high school. He goes out one night to get ice cream and meet up with a friend at a bar. And his friend has just won this super prestigious like physics award, and he's kind of jealous. And then he's headed back to the house with his ice cream, and he gets abducted by this guy in like a creepy mask and carried out to this warehouse. He injects him with this like serum and then throws him in this box, and he wakes up in this science lab.
Oh my. Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out how much further to go. Basically, it involves the multiverse.
I was going
to
say, I know, I've read like, this.
And things
you've
going
read
on.
This.
Oh, you've read this book.
I have read it. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you can help me figure out how much more
Bill,
to explain.
Bill is so
but,
well
like,
read. Oh, wow.
Okay. No, it. Well, I mean, because that's it. I mean, because how do I even say that? Because there is some big reveals when you start talking about the multiverse. Because almost mentioning the multiverse is part of a reveal. That comes a little bit later. But it's a fascinating book on, I don't know, thinking about what that would be like if there are a million of you in the multiverse, or 10 million or 100 million of you in the multiverse.
Or an infinite number of you.
Exactly. And it's an interesting study on how would that really affect your worldview and the way your way of thinking about life and the choices you've made and all these things, if that was actually a reality. So it was pretty cool.
Well, it certainly can't be any worse than Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. So
I liked that movie.
That was so bad.
That is the weirdest movie I've ever watched in my life, but I still like it.
So. For the life of me, I cannot figure out how that won Best Picture. That what a stinker. I'm convinced
Hot dog fingers, man.
25 years from now, people are going to be like, yeah, we got that one wrong.
That's funny.
I hated it.
Is it on Apple TV? Because I was looking forward to watch. It's somewhere weird.
Dude, it sucks, Bill.
Well, I got to watch
it.
I
watched it on Amazon.
Oh, really? Okay.
Amazon Prime.
I think it's gone off then or something.
Give it a shot. You got to make it through the first 50% of the movie and just know that you're going to have absolutely
no idea. You really don't. It doesn't get better. It just gets worse.
Okay.
All right.
Talk about some games.
Oh, we got a couple more things to talk about.
Oh, wow.
We've been bantering for so long. We get so fired up in our banter lately. Hopefully people don't mind, but you know.
27 minutes of it.
Oh, my. That's pre-editing. So we're like at 20 right now, right?
I'm sure you're going to cut all that Chris stuff out.
Yeah, just cut all that episode crap out.
We only need the top three Black Mirror episodes. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. What do we have to drink tonight, Chris?
Yeah, we're having a drink. I didn't forget this time.
Yay.
All right.
And not in the hot house.
That's right. So tonight, I made a cocktail called Counting Sheep.
Ooh, that is very good.
And
I
that
just
is,
tried it for the first time.
Yeah, and that is because we are reviewing a game about sheep tonight. So that's where that came from. A game called Attribute.
Which actually has nothing to do with sheep.
Not really. Very little. Counting Sheep is 1.5 ounces black rum, 1 ounce vodka, 1/2 ounce of white creme de cacao, which is the key here, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, two dashes of Peychaud's bitters, shake, strain, and then grate with some dark chocolate on the top, which is also required.
It's pretty good.
It's very good.
I like it too. I actually would do a little less lemon, I think, next time.
Yeah.
I tried to get that Cruzan Blackstrap rum that I love so much, and they didn't have it, but I'm telling you, that and this would be mind-blowing. This is Kraken, which is just meh, in my opinion, but yeah, it's a pretty good drink.
I'll have to write that one down.
Yeah, man.
All right, I swear I'm going to do a cocktail book at some point.
We need to.
But it's just a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
We need a couple more Patreon backers.
Maybe we do. Before that happens. Well, maybe we'll get a couple. That's a good segue, because we're talking about something fun on Backstage today.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
We're starting another series that we're going to slowly crawl through in Hidden Gem style. So whenever we get a fancy and we want to, what we're going to start doing is actually starting tonight, we're going through the BGG Top 100. Actually, we'll probably go beyond the Top 100, because we're actually starting at number one.
Yeah, weirdly, Chris decided to start at one, unlike every other top whatever list. But it's fine.
So the thought process is we may go past 100. Mm-hmm. So we're going to, and you gotta get the people excited, you know? So we're going to start with number 1 through 10.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go through each one at a time. If we've played them, we're going to talk about them and kind of how we feel about them just briefly in general. So that's what we're going to talk about Backstage.
I will tell you, as we were playing these top 10 games in this room, I thought the walls were going to crumble around just for the blasphemy of playing a top 10 game.
Yeah, we played Dune Imperium a couple of nights ago.
We did. It was awesome.
Yeah. Can't wait to hear what Jason thinks about that one, because that was your first time, I think, right?
Yep.
Okay, save it. Can't give it away now or nobody will subscribe.
That's true.
Then the cocktail book will never happen.
And it'll never happen. All right, so last thing, we'll wrap it up real quick. As mentioned, we're doing a designer spotlight on Marcel André Casasola Merkel. Pretty prolific designer, at least more back in the day. He's not as active these days, and sadly, it was pretty hard to find stuff on this designer. And that's a shame, because he has a lot of solid designs, as it turns out, but there just isn't a lot on him. But I'll tell you what I could find out. So he was born in Nuremberg, Germany on August the 10th, 1977, and he currently resides in Munich, Germany. He works as a computer programmer / coder. What is up with that?
Super smart.
I mean,
what's up with what?
I mean, like, every board gamer is a computer programmer, I feel like.
I mean, I feel like
you, Cameron, Bill,
I feel
Ken.
Like they're parallel universes, right? Like, programming and the structure to it and all of that translates very well into board game rounds and mechanisms and things. Right. I don't know.
Follow this rule set.
That makes sense.
So why the hell are you here?
Exactly, because I can barely turn on a computer, no lie. So, That always amazes me. They're just very popular with y'all. All right, he started designing games in 1997. Interestingly, I did not know this, he was one of the three co-founders of Lookout Games. So Lookout Games is Agricola, Caverna, Lahav, some heavy hitters. So he co-founded that with
Uwe
Rosenberg and Hanno Gerke. Interestingly, Lookout Games' first published game is a little party game about sheep called Attribute.
Oh, wow.
Can you believe Lookout Games' first game is Attribute?
Wow.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, that's wild.
Bad.
Whoa, dude. All right.
In his foreshadowing.
In his spare time, he likes to illustrate. He likes to draw. And just to mention real quickly, he has been nominated for the Spiel 4 times, which, again, just surprises me, because you never hear this guy talked about. Again, he's more active back in the day, but being nominated for the Spiel 4 times is pretty good.
Yeah.
So he was nominated in 1998 for Verrader, 2002 for Attribute, 2003 for Attica, and 2012 for Santa Cruz.
Wow.
We've got recommended.
Recommended.
Is that the same as?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nominated / recommended list. Yeah.
Okay. So that means they were voted on, and he could have won.
Could have won.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He never won, but he was nominated 4 times.
That's pretty good chops.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's it.
Okay. That was a pretty good book report.
Best I could do without being able to read German. So.
Oh, okay. We don't know, like, where he likes to sleep or what his hobbies are.
What spoons he collects.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I feel like we've talked enough.
Yep.
Let's get into the games, yeah?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
attribute. Contains 164 attribute cards. 60 sheep cards. One rules booklet. And more than 3,832 sheep. A party game for the whole flock.
We'd have to do so much editing.
Attribute.
Attribute. That was awesome, Chris.
I think that was good. Yeah.
You did a good job with the sheep voice on that.
We'd have to do so much editing on that.
Woo. Yeah, that was a good one. It's keeper. It may not be as good as, what was the perfume commercial we did?
Oh.
Expedition Famous Explorers.
Expedition
Famous.
That was Dan Smith. We need to get him back on here.
We do need to get him back. All right. Attribute. Published in 2002. Going way back in the time machine here. Publisher has mentioned Lookout Games and also Z-Man Games. At the time of this recording, its BGG ranking is 4,190. As mentioned, designer Marcel Andre Casasola Merkel. It's a sole design. Brief rule summary for Attribute. And this won't take very long. It's pretty straightforward. All right. Attribute is a word association style party game where the players are trying to make meaningful associations between randomly assigned words and clues given by the players. At the start of each round of play, each player will be assigned a sheep card, which will either be black or white in color, and will receive a hand of four cards, each of which will have a random word on them. Each player will secretly look at the color of their sheep on their sheep card and then place it face down in front of them. Now, the active player will look at his or her cards and come up with a clue, which can consist of a single word or a phrase. If the clue giver has a white sheep card, they want to give a word or phrase clue that pairs nicely with a word card that they have in their hand.
Green?
Green or white. Yeah, so okay. The card's green, the sheep is white. Okay?
Oh.
So let's say that they have a card in their hand that has the word ice on it. They could give a clue cold, for example, because again, they have a white sheep or a green card and they want there to be a positive association there. Okay. However, if they have a black sheep card in front of them, they want to give a word or phrase clue that is the opposite of a card they are holding in their hand. So for example, if they have a card that says sauna on it, they could give the clue cold because saunas are not cold, they're hot, right? That's the general idea. So once the active clue giver has announced their clue, word, or phrase, all of the other players must now look at their hand of cards and try to choose a word card that matches well with that clue, so the clue that the active player gave, if they have a white sheep card. Or they have to choose a card from their hand that does not match well with the clue that the active player gave if they have a black sheep card. Once all of the players have chosen their word card, they place it face down in front of them on top of their sheep card, which again is also face down. Then, on the count of three, all players will simultaneously flip face up their word cards. The players will then try to quickly slap a word card that they think is associated with a white sheep card. Okay? Not a black sheep card. You're trying to slap a card that you think is associated with a white sheep, has a white sheep under it. Okay? A player can only take one set of word and sheep cards from in front of another player. If a player is not quick enough to initially capture a pair of cards in the first few seconds, and they think that only black sheep are left in front of the other remaining players, they are not obligated to take those cards. They just say, I'm not going to grab anything because I think they're all black sheep left. Once all of the players are settled and no one else wants to capture cards, the round is scored. All right, pay close attention here. If a player grabbed a word card associated with a white sheep, that player scores a point. If a player grabbed a word card associated with a black sheep, that player loses a point. If a player started the round with a black sheep in front of them, and at the end of the round nobody took that word card because they gave a good opposite or unrelated clue, that player will score a point for them not having their card taken.
Okay. Right.
Because it was a black sheep.
I'm already confused.
Yeah. If the player started the round with a white sheep in front of them, And at the end of the round, nobody took their word card. That player actually loses a point. So if you have a white sheep, you want it to get grabbed by somebody. You need to give a good clue. The game will continue on in this way until each player has been the clue giver a certain number of times. And then at that point, the player with the highest score wins the game. It's generally how you play attribute. Attribute. All right. This is a pretty simple game.
You say that.
I say that. We'll get to that. It's a party game, so the rules should be pretty straightforward, right? Mm-hmm. And in essence, it's straightforward. So much so that I have a hard time coming up with any kind of clever mechanism type question here. So I think we should just start by saying or asking.
Do you like synonyms better or antonyms better?
Right, exactly. What did you like about the game?
I thought with the group that we had fun playing it. We laughed about it. We laughed about all the wrongs and the rights. Because you are put in kind of funny situations where somebody will give a clue and you have either the black or the white sheep and just nothing matches what you need to do. Nothing matches the opposite. Nothing matches the other. And you just have to make your best guess, right? And there's something kind of funny about that. And especially seeing what people ended up picking. Especially was on the edge and people kind of making a guess to saying, okay, that's close to that. Is it really there or not? And having to do it since it's a real-time slap it kind of thing. It was fun to watch people process that. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a good part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I have much to say here. There was a lot of variety to the words, I will say that.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of word cards, yeah.
Which puts you in those situations, like Bill said, where you have a lot of random words that you're trying to associate when you might not have something that goes real well with the clue that was given. That can lead to some funny moments.
Yeah.
I felt like we laughed more at the fact that we couldn't keep track of the rules and how to how to score the dang thing, which is we'll get to in a second.
Yeah, I'm sure.
What did you think?
No, I agree with both of you. I think there were some pretty fun moments for some interesting word associations. Again, just to reiterate, because there's not a whole lot else to talk about here. Giving the clue as the clue giver is easy, right? You look at your hand and you can very easily come up with an opposite, an antonym or a synonym, as it were. Pretty easy, right?
Right.
But if you're not the clue giver, you really have to think hard about which word do I have works here? You know what I mean? And so that allows for some interesting and fun, well, maybe somebody would make this connection, you know? And some people do. And I remember even Ken, when we were playing, I think the clue was old. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was old. I remember this specifically. And he played the word bold, which has nothing to do with old.
Right.
But my thought was, I remember it was not a card that was grabbed fast. Mm-hmm. And I was not fast enough to get one of the obvious ones early. And I kept staring at his card and I was like, did he pick bold because it sounds like old?
Mm-hmm.
And I slapped his card and it was right. That's what he was thinking, right?
Right.
So things like that happen in this game and that is fun, you know? Like
you still lost. It's fine.
I still lost. But I had a little moment of victory there with that kind of clever association. So, you know, I can appreciate what the game is trying to do there.
Right. Yeah, I like word games like this. What you just said was, I kind of find that fun in a game. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Before we get into cons, Jason, well, I will say one more thing. I do like how the point scoring works and that even if you're not fast, per se, you can still score, right? Mm-hmm. So I may not be a fast slapper, but if I have a black sheep, I would still get a point if I gave a good clue and somebody took that card from in front of me, right? So while speed is important here, I'm not saying it's not, and probably faster players will win, you can at least score in other ways, right? By giving a decent clue.
If you can remember what they are.
If you can remember the rules, we're getting there. So yeah, that's all I'll say about it. You have anything else positive to say, Bill?
It's funny because I don't know if I mentioned it on here, but we'll play Contact for those out there who know what Contact is in my family all the time, especially in the beach, out in the waves. And there is a certain level of, if you have people in your family, you know how people think kind of thing.
Yeah, totally.
And I could see in this game, we're in a group of family and like my daughters, I think would love this game because they think they have a mental connection with each other. And I can imagine that they would put cards down and just like, you know what I mean when I put this card down and could have fun doing that in a family setting.
Yeah, totally.
But that's about it.
Okay, Jason. Let it rip.
I'm not going to be that mean, but Yeah, I mean, I think we've alluded to it already. This game is super, super simple.
Yes,
it's synonyms and antonyms. But it's also not, weirdly.
It's true.
It probably didn't come through in the rules. Maybe it did.
Because I did such a good job explaining it.
Oh, yeah. There is something about the way this game scores, and the green and the red cards, or the white and the black sheep, and like, your objectives changing based on whether you're the person giving the clue or not giving the clue, or whether you have a white sheep or a black sheep. It's just, I don't know. I had the hardest time in this game keeping track of, like, what am I trying to do right now? Like,
what
kind of
scores?
Clue, what client? How do I score right now? What kind of clue am I supposed to be giving?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I gave away half of my points that I won because I gave them away at the wrong time and I didn't need to.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, so I have a white sheep. And I'm not giving a clue, so that means I need to give a good clue so that somebody does take my card. Oh, wait, no, I don't want them to take my card.
I do want them to take my card.
Yeah, so I don't know. That in and of itself was enough to throw the caution flag on this one. I think in addition to that, the gameplay itself, I don't know if you guys felt this way, especially as the clue giver. Most word games make you think as a clue giver. Like, you have to be clever. You have to think about something creative to get people to, like... Like, I think of Montage.
Yeah.
Or...
Such a good game.
Even Codenames, right?
Not as good.
Not as good. But, like, word games that I like... Because I enjoy word games a lot, actually. I loved Montage. This game, I never spent more than 2 seconds thinking about my clue. Because it's like, okay, well, I have a red card. I'm going to think of the word that is the opposite of the word that I have on my card. And that's the clue that I'm going to give.
Yep.
I have a green card. I'm going to think of a synonym for this. And that's the clue that I'm going to give. Like, it's synonyms and antonyms. So it didn't feel like there was a whole lot to think about. What it really felt like it came down to was the speed element of, like, can I grab a green card quickly? And in that case, every single time I was looking at the clue giver's card.
Exactly.
Because
there's just going to be the clearest.
It's going to be the most distinct because they know what clue they have on their card and they're going to give a synonym or an antonym.
It will be very easy to figure them out
because that's what they're incentivized to do, right? You're never incentivized to give a clue that's less than helpful because
it hurts you.
I mean, you could in theory like do that to throw somebody else off and give them a negative point, but it doesn't benefit you.
Right.
It only hurts them. So I don't know. There just didn't really seem to be a whole lot of, I don't want to say strategy because it's not what I'm looking for here necessarily. It's just, it felt oversimplified and yet also weirdly frustrating and complicated to figure out what I'm trying to do. So yeah, that was my thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that. I mean, there was, I agree with everything Jason was saying, but I don't know. There was a flavor of still fun to it, but I fully appreciate every word that you said, Jason.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that as you were saying it because I was like, well, yeah, we did laugh at a couple moments, but I was also thinking there were a lot of times when I had words in my hand and I needed to use them and I was like, ah, that's funny, like if I use that word. But any hilarity that would come from playing a word like that, you either have to announce before the turn or it just kind of gets lost because everything happens in that real-time element.
Yeah.
So everybody's just trying to slap something real fast.
Yeah.
So nobody's like, oh, that's a funny clue.
There's no
like,
time to ruminate over it, yeah.
Yeah, you don't even like notice that because you're just like trying to slap a card real fast.
I 100% agree with both of you. I don't have a whole lot more to add. I'll just mention one more thing, which was a real issue for me, actually. Because this is a speed game, and this is just unavoidable in speed games, but... In this particular game, it's actually a hindrance to the gameplay if you're trying to play it as a game, right? It's lighthearted, but you're trying to win, like in any game, right? Mm-hmm. The problem with this game is because you have to be fast, and it takes fractions of a second for people to come to conclusions in this game. Mm-hmm. And because everybody at the table knows that, everybody's hand is hovering over the table because everybody's ready to slap within a second. Mm-hmm. And that hovering of hands obscures the table. There were several times I could not see what was on Jason's card because his hand was blocking it, but I can't blame him because he's trying to be ready, right? But there were just hands everywhere, and I was trying to look around people's hands, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There are things about this game from a design standpoint that when you compare it to more modern designs are problematic, you know what I mean? And that was another one, right?
Are we ready for final thoughts?
Yeah, we're going to wrap it up. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
I give this game a 2.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I can see it floating for a little bit in the right group. I feel like we're a fairly forgiving group because we all know each other really well and we're able to sort of laugh at things even if they're not the best.
Yeah.
But I don't know how well this would fly in a normal group.
Yeah.
Just the rules confusion, I feel like, could knock it out of contention right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And even without that, it just wasn't fun in the long term. So, yeah, I landed on 2 for this one.
Okay. So, for me, there's a phrase that kind of floats around in board game circles, especially within review circles. People will say, this game has been replaced by this game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, board game reviewers really like to say that. And I kind of hate that in a lot of ways because, obviously, our shtick on this show is reviewing older games, usually, that a lot of people would say have been replaced by more modern designs. And I think you can make an argument that, in a lot of ways, at least in our opinion, we've regressed in modern war game design. And I don't think a lot of older games have been replaced. I think they're actually maybe superior in a lot of ways to more modern designs. However, in this particular case, I do feel like that attribute, for its time, was probably pretty fun because this was right around the times that Apples to Apples came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that clever word association was kind of new and interesting and people hadn't seen it before. But it's just been done so much better now.
Right.
Dixit, for me, comes to mind. I think Dixit's an awesome game. And it just takes this idea of word association and it just does it so much better that I can't see why you would ever play Attribute instead of a game like that. It just, there's no reason to.
Yeah.
Interesting for its time, but it just doesn't hold up anymore for all the reasons that we mentioned. A party game should be easy to understand, right?
Right.
And the way this game scores is kind of weird, and so it makes it a little hard to understand, and that automatically is a hindrance for party games, right?
Yeah.
So to me, I don't think it's bad necessarily. It's kind of on the 2-3 line. I gave it a 3, mostly because I just think it's irrelevant, for lack of a better word. It's just there's no reason to play a game like this anymore.
Yeah.
Let's give it a 3.
Yeah, that's fair, and I agree with it. I mean, it's funny. You mentioned Apples to Apples because I have here that, you know, I like this game better than Apples to Apples because I don't necessarily like the judging or even Cards Against Humanity. I mean, that was fun when it first came out, but yeah. The fact that everybody plays at once, I kind of like. I think it scales well, kind of thing that we didn't mention. So you can play it with a bunch of people. That part's good. But there is a huge downside to everybody grokking the rules because that was a big part of our game. Is like, is this right? did I do this right? I mean, what happens now at the end? I mean, am I scoring this correctly? And that happened the whole time we were playing the game. And I don't think it has legs to play it longer than a few minutes. I mean, you play it 2 or 3 rounds and you're kind of, okay, I've seen this. I'm kind of done with it now. So I don't ever see really playing it out very much. And like you, Chris, the game that came to mind to me that scales well is Just One.
As far as something another
like
good one
that would play like this. But anyway, I gave it a 3 as well, just on all those lines.
Just One's a great game.
It is. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, where can people find a copy of Attribute if they're looking for it?
Yeah, so as it turns out, if party games are your thing and you want to give it a go anyways, despite what we might have said, there are copies available on Noble Knight. Our sponsors are Noble Knight Games. We appreciate them. And there are several pretty cheap copies available there. So if you want to use them, and we'd appreciate it if you did, you can use our discount code. That is GEMS10. That's the number 10. GEMS10 off. You get 10% off of your order. There are also 12 copies available on BGG Marketplace.
And those are our thoughts on Attribute.
I was going to say, you better buy.
Attribute.
Rich raw material deposits, fertile landscapes, and exotic animals are to be discovered. After months of hardship on the high seas, the redeeming call finally rings across the deck. Land in sight! Players take on the role of explorers who settle new lands. They must use their limited resources cleverly to secure the most profitable building sites on the island.
That's it.
Oh, wow. You left me hanging there.
Right. Yeah. I was leaning forward.
For cliffhanger.
More. Yeah, you didn't end that very well.
I did it intentionally.
It wasn't clear.
It was on purpose. Yeah. All right. Santa Cruz, published in 2012. Spiel des Jahres recommended in 2012.
Yeah, 2012, what a great year.
Published by
Vintage.
Published by Philosophia Editions and Hans im Glück.
Uh-huh.
Designed, of course, by Marcel André Casasola Merkel. And currently ranked on BGG 2,993.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do my best to give a rules summary of this game. It is not super complicated, but there is a lot going on.
Yeah.
And weird stuff to explain.
Mm-hmm.
So, in Santa Cruz, players are populating the islands of Santa Cruz with houses, churches, and lighthouses in order to score the most points over two rounds of play. A two-round thing is important. I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
The board is made up of one primary island and two smaller islands. The islands have several spaces on them that are connected by roads, rivers, or both. The spaces are either coastal spaces, inland spaces, or volcano spaces. Each of these spots receives a random token from a pile of tokens of its type. So, coastal spaces get coastal tokens, inland get inland tokens, etc. So the values on the spaces will be randomized each game. The coastal spaces start the game face up, while the others are face down. Each player starts the game with one building on a coastal space of their choice. Each round, players will play cards from a deck of seven cards to build a network of their buildings on the board. So you're trying to connect your buildings together. They have to be connected by these roads or rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Cards have either a road, a river, or a ship printed on them, allowing the player to place a building on a space connected to their existing network. Note that roads only allow moving one space at a time along a road, whereas rivers allow the player to place in any space along a river that they already have at least one building on.
Mm-hmm.
Ships, on the other hand, allow players to place a building on any coastal space. Each space has one of the three building types printed on it, indicating which of the wooden building pieces they have in front of them they must place on that spot. If a player does not have a building of the required type, they cannot place on that space. When placing on a space, any tokens on spaces directly adjacent to that space that are face down get flipped face up. So slowly the board gets revealed over time. Each space additionally has a point value, points being scored immediately when the building is placed there. Lastly, spaces also have other symbols on them. These are either resources, wood, gold, sheep, sugar, fish. And these are important for scoring, which I'll come back to in a second.
Totally.
Or they have birds, which awards a player a random bird token, which has a point value between 1 and 3. So that's the basic gist of the game. You're playing cards that deal with the particular types of transportation, I guess, roads and rivers yep. and ships, to place out new buildings on new spaces in order to score points.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a couple of additional rules that spice things up a good bit. So the first of these is that each player is dealt a number of scoring cards based on the player count. So in a four-player game, each player gets two of these. It changes a little bit with player count. These are from a deck of 16 unique scoring cards. These scoring cards are added to the player's hands and are not revealed to other players until they're played. So on a player's turn, they have the option to either play one of their normal deck cards to place a new building, or to play a scoring card. These scoring cards affect every player.
Yep, huge.
This is important.
Yep.
So each player who meets the scoring criteria of a given card will score. That makes timing essential, and also makes essential paying attention to what other players are up to.
Yes.
So for example, any player who has a building on a sheep resource will score 7 points. Score 6 points if you have built at least one of each of the three building types. Score 7 points for at least 4 buildings that are all connected together.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. You might be thinking, well, wouldn't all your buildings be connected together? But rivers let you skip over spaces.
Yep.
Coastal spaces, you can jump to any coastal space you want. Right. So your buildings might not all be connected together. Another example would be score 3 points for each building you've built on the coast or on a river or on the volcano. Or score -2 points for every building you have on a volcano.
I'm sure we'll talk about that later.
Et cetera, et cetera. There's 16 of these different scoring cards, and they all do something slightly different. So another twist is that each of the card decks, the 7 cards with the ships and the roads and the rivers, each of the decks used by players has a slightly different distribution of roads and rivers and sea cards, making it somewhat asymmetrical. This can actually make a huge difference in how you plan your turn.
Yeah.
Every deck also has a double wild card, allowing the player to do two builds in one turn, both with the same movement type, but of their choice. Lastly, I mentioned way back at the beginning that the game is played over two rounds. So in each round, players play out all seven of their cards, plus all of their scoring cards. But between the first and the second round, a few things change. All of the buildings built in the first round are ripped off the board. The tokens stay in place. So we've slowly revealed these spaces over the first round, so players know what is where now.
Mm-hmm.
All of those tokens stay where they are, but everybody's buildings come back to them. Then, in reverse order of current score, players have the option to choose a different deck from an opponent, taking both their normal cards and their scoring cards.
Yeah.
Then, on top of all of that, all players are dealt one additional scoring card from those that were left out in the beginning, and they get to discard one of the three cards that they now have. So they might keep the one that they were just dealt, they might get rid of the one they were just dealt, they might get rid of one of the other ones. After two full rounds, bird tokens, which we talked about a long time ago, are revealed and added to a player's score, and then the player with the highest score wins the game.
Nice.
Good job,
that
Jason.
That felt like a really long explanation, but there's a lot going on in this
for,
game.
For a game that's not very complicated, there are a lot of intricacies that I hope we'll expound upon, that if you don't understand this game, it's a weird one, right?
Yeah.
This game is unique.
It is, but I mean, whatever Jason said, don't let it scare you away from the game, because I think it's intuitive once you get it, and the rules are really not that difficult when you play it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, all that said, I mean, I think one of the biggest drivers in this game of what really fuels the engine of this game is the player-controlled scoring, right? Every player has these scorecards that only they know about that they can play pretty much at any time they want. So what did you guys think about that? I feel like it has a pretty big impact on the gameplay. Do you guys agree? How so?
Yeah, this is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this supremely interesting. You might be thinking to yourself, and it's reasonable because I thought this when I read the rules the first time. Well, if I've got a card that scores 7 points, if I'm on sheep, if I'm on a space that scores sheep and I'm the only one on there, my next turn I should play that card so that I'm the only one that gets those points and nobody else gets them. And that would be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But what you'll find yourself doing in this game is, let's say the turn before my turn, Jason places a house and he places on wood. So now I'm like, does Jason have a wood scoring card?
Mm-hmm.
And I see an opportunity to get on wood. Maybe I'll wait a turn.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't see anybody else is able to get on sheep right now. It's pretty safe. I'm going to place on wood and I'll score my sheep card next turn.
Right.
And then it comes to my next turn and I'm like, I should probably score my sheep card, but I'm getting ready to get blocked off to the spot I really need to go.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll wait and score it next time, and you will find yourself constantly doing that with yourself the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because it's important to understand that when you score, you're not doing anything on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And getting on important spots on the board is critical.
Absolutely.
To capitalize on other players' scoring cards and to get where you need to get. So you feel this constant tension of, I really need to play the scoring card before more people get it, and I'm sharing those points with everybody, but I really need to go here and there. And you're just constantly playing that game in your head the whole time, and that's great. I love that.
Yeah, no, I think this adds a ton of tension to the game.
Mm-hmm.
Every play, you're trying to decide, is it more valuable for me to do something on the board or to get my scoring card out?
Right.
And it's great when you get a scoring card that you know you're safe to wait until the very end of the round to play. Right, because either it's impossible for other players to qualify for that scoring, or you know, you just have it dominated.
Right.
So yeah, I really enjoyed that part of the game. It also forces you to constantly be keeping track of what other players are doing.
Totally.
Right? It's not multiplayer solitaire. You always have to be paying attention to, like, where's Bill building? Where's Chris building?
Mm-hmm.
Where's Cameron building? So that you can try to figure out. It has a little bit of that, like, hidden identity stuff from, like, Name of the Rose and all those other games that we've played, where you're trying to suss out what other players are doing. That can be pretty difficult at times, especially with certain scoring cards, which maybe we'll come back to that later. But
which is kind of wild to me, because not only that, I found myself often being drawn to the fact of, let me get on my resource and cash out early so nobody else has my points. Right. And so that whole, I'm monitoring everybody else, I felt like I wanted to get that out of the way, because
Yeah, but that comes at a cost, though, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because if Jason, on the turn before you, placed on wood.
Oh, sure.
And you could get on wood, but you chose not to play your scoring card, and then Jason on his next turn plays his wood scoring card, you're even.
Oh, absolutely. Right? But if we're playing with four players, the other two people aren't.
That's true. But the more that you can capitalize on other people's scoring cards, the better you're going to do, right?
Oh, 100%.
So you constantly feel like the tension to be like, oh, should I get on this now or should I just score my freaking card, right?
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I hope that our listeners are understanding what we're saying because, like I said, there's no game really like, it's a weird one, but there's some cleverness going on here.
There's also good tension, too. Maybe this is obvious, but I mean, you have more than one scoring card. And you can't start everywhere on the board. You only start in one location. So you have to be thinking through, like, you're not always going to be able to just immediately jump on your scoring criteria and score it.
Right? Yeah.
Other scoring cards are like score 3 points for every location you have on a river, right? Mm-hmm. And so those, they take time to build up, right? So it's not like you can, I feel like we're giving the impression that if you have a particular scoring card, you just jump on that right from the get-go, and you have to decide when to score it, right? It's more than that, because you can't always just immediately jump on your scoring criteria. Sometimes that takes time. Sometimes you can. But planning out, okay, well, like, I have to balance trying to get as many river spaces as I can get with also trying to do what Chris is doing and do what Bill is doing to some degree, that adds a lot more decision space.
So there's a whole other dimension to this that we hadn't necessarily talked about, because the four decks are not symmetrical. They're asymmetrical. Nope. There's a deck that is balanced of your seas, your rivers, and your roads. There's one that's river-centric, one that's road-centric, and one that's sea-centric. And so that part is pretty fascinating in and of itself, because each one of those can kind of create a bottleneck when you're actually looking to capture those resources, you may not be able to get to it. Mm-hmm. So how did you guys feel about the decks?
I thought that was really interesting. I think there are some gotchas with that, which I'm sure we'll come back to.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting to try to figure out that flexibility. And what they did, which was brilliant, was adding in the double wild.
Right.
Because every deck has the double wild, which is where you do two builds and you get to choose what it is. Right. Mm-hmm. So even if I have the sea-centric deck, I have that double wild that I can double up on roads, or I can double up on rivers if that's something that I need to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like yet another decision point of like, what do I do with this double card? Because it's two of the same thing, but it gives me that flexibility to be able to offset the fact that my deck is maybe weighted in a certain direction.
Right. And get into a place that you may not have been able to get into.
Yeah.
In
because
striking point.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, like if you have roads, a lot of the resources are inland.
Yeah.
Right. So the wood and the sheep and all that stuff. So if you have roads, you can get to the resources really well. But on roads, you can only move one space at a time. So you're like moving really slowly, but you can get to everything. With rivers, you have a lot more flexibility because you can skip over spaces along the rivers. I don't know if I explained that in the rules, but
you did.
You can skip over spaces on the rivers, but there aren't very many river spots. So you have all these cards. I think we found that, like, most people who were playing the river deck were like ending the round with like cards they couldn't play.
Yeah.
Because there just weren't any spots left.
Right.
And then the sea, like, you have tons of flexibility. You can move anywhere you want because you can go to any sea space. You can get to the extra islands. You can do all this stuff.
You're not going to get locked in.
But you can't get inland.
Right.
And the spaces on the coast are really just point scoring. They don't give, like,
they're not resources.
Like the points on the spaces themselves. Like they don't give you resources and stuff to score off of other people's scorecards. So, yeah, it's an interesting trade-off.
I'm still not sure how I feel about this. This might, as Jason alluded to, it's kind of transitioning into maybe a con. It's interesting because if you have the right scorecards, a deck that might otherwise be undesirable can be really desirable.
Right.
So there's a scoring card where you get 3 points for every building that you have on a coastal space.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have the deck that has the four coastal cards on it, you can go nutso, right?
Right.
And score like a bunch of points.
It's like the scythe debate of like, if you get the right two boards combined, do you have an unfair advantage over other players?
Yeah, you can really rack up. But I agree with Jason too. Getting the deck that has a lot of water in it, especially if you're not incentivized to build on water, can be almost seen as a disadvantage because sometimes you won't even be able to get your cards played out because all the water spots get grabbed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. There's pros and cons to that, but I do like how the choice of deck can play to the scoring cards you have, but sometimes you might just get screwed with a deck you don't want, right?
Right.
I mean, I think in two of the games we played, the person who got the river deck got the river scoring card.
Yeah.
Which that's huge, right? Mm-hmm. If you get the river deck where you can go anywhere you want on rivers and you get a card where you can score 3 points for every spot you have on a river.
Yeah.
I mean, scoring 18 points or 15 points or something off of one scorecard, that's inherently to the exclusion of other players.
Right.
Right? Because if you have all the river spaces, they don't.
Like, although that's some road spaces overlap with the river spaces.
Oh, that's true.
And everybody has some river cards.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's where it's, and you mentioned this, Jason, I couldn't agree more. That's why it's paramount in this game. If you want to do well, you constantly have to be watching what your opponents are doing.
Right.
Like, if in the first three rounds, Jason is building on water every time, I'm starting to think, does he have that water card where you score? And now I'm going to start building on water.
Right.
Because I think he probably has it, right? And I want to get in on that scoring, right? Absolutely. Interesting in that way.
Right. And also another wrinkle is after the first round, the person who's in last place has a first choice on decks. And choosing the decks, you also know what reward cards come with that deck.
Yes.
So I think that happened in one of our games where somebody picked up, I think it was you, Jason, picked up the river deck because it had the river scoring one in it. So that kind of helps you out.
Still
and it's kind
don't
of
think I won that game, but...
No, yeah, I think I won that one because of the volcano.
Yeah. So we want to transition volcano into cons?
That is not a con.
I didn't say it was necessarily, but I guess we've been talking for a bit. We should probably talk a little bit about the volcano. So there is one gotcha card in this game, kind of. There are actually two cards that you need to understand in this game. So there are some spots on the board that are adjacent to volcanoes. They're super valuable. They score a lot of points, and they give you really good things. But there is one scoring card in the game that, when played, destroys every building next to those volcanoes. You don't lose the points, but you lose the buildings, and you take -2 for every building you build adjacent to it. On the flip side of that, there's also a card that gives you +3 points for every time you build next to a volcano.
Right.
So you're like, okay, do I want to build here? Somebody have that card? These spots are awesome. Am I going to get shellacked with this -2 card? Which it can really hit you. It got Jason one time in one of our games. He looked like he had food poisoning. He was so upset about it.
Well, yeah, because so in that game, in the first round, the +3 point for Volcano's scoring card had been in the game.
Yeah.
So it was
so
like,
everybody
well,
was rushing for him.
Well, it makes sense that that should stay in the game. Well, Bill randomly got the -2 card with the deck with the +3 card, threw out the +3 card, and kept the -2 card.
No, I kept the +3 and the -2. So I cleared out the volcano, and then I
and then you built on it.
Then yeah, I even, built on it, better. And then cashed
what a guy
out the +3.
Even better. What a guy, yeah. And I feel like having that like one gotcha card in the deck, there's games that do that where it's like, for the most part, the game's pretty fair and tame. And then they throw in this like one
negative card.
Like, take that card. And it's just like, come on. Like, if you're going to be a take that game, be a take that game. Don't be like a normal Euro game and then throw in that one wrench that's just going to screw over one person and like piss them off forever at the game. Right? I don't know why designers do that, but I understand why it's there. It adds tension. It adds a decision point. I get it, right? But it's like, either be a game that's about take that or don't. Like,
you were just greedy. You put 3 cities down around the volcano. And so,
I thought I was incentivized to. And
I'm glad I was able to prove you wrong.
I can live with it giving me negative points, but giving you negative points and destroying your buildings?
Oh, that was killer.
That's huge.
Because you might need those buildings to score your scoring cards.
Yeah, I had placed on 3... that's 3 turns. Just destroyed. Obliterated. In a round where there are 7 turns. 3 turns destroyed. And all of the resources that I got access to doing that, gone. All of it.
It felt so good.
It's basically, you're done. If that happens to you, you're done. Like, there's no coming back from it. So, yeah, I have thoughts about that I've already expressed. So, we'll leave it at that.
I will say, to play it is kind of a high cost for you because you're not necessarily scoring for yourself, right? Because you could be getting pluses, depending on who's on there.
Pulling people back is like scoring pulling, for yourself.
I mean, sort
it
of,
worked,
but
it worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah, it did. But I mean, are you necessarily pulling back the person in his first place? It's a little bit of a crapshoot whether it's going to be that or...
Not to mention, you can just build right back on the spot you got blown off of.
Right.
But you may not have the cards.
Right.
To do that, right?
Yeah.
Because you spent all your roads already. I don't know. It's painful, no doubt.
It is, absolutely is. And in the game that we played, it really came out at almost a perfect time because everybody filled up the volcano super early.
Oh, yeah. It was well played.
It was, yeah. It was very lucky. Very lucky.
I will say you played it well. Given that that mechanism is in the game, you used it to the best of its ability.
Yeah.
It just sucks. So... And I don't like it.
All right. We want to wrap it up? We got some good thoughts here.
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. It's my turn to start, yeah?
Sure.
All right. Wow. This game is pretty fantastic. This game surprised me. I was not sure what to expect. I hadn't really even heard of this game. The only reason I acquired it is because it's a Spiel nominee, and we have that series, and I knew we had to play it. It's hard to find a copy here. It's all in German, although it is language independent. But I had a hard time tracking it down. But man, I am glad that I did. This game is cool. I really like this game for all the reasons that we mentioned. But I'll reiterate one point that Jason mentioned early in the review. And that this game really, in my opinion, has zero mental downtime. Because on turns that are not your turn, you better be paying attention to what everybody's doing.
Right.
If you want to do well, and you will be. I was constantly engaged in this turn because every time Bill or Cameron did something, I was like, why did he do that? Mm-hmm. What does he know that I don't know? What is he trying to accomplish? And that kept me engaged the whole time. Add to that, that great tension that we already talked about of when to play the scoring cards versus the building cards. I loved that about this. And also, outside of the volcano and that one little gotcha, there's really not really any luck. Really? Or random elements in this game. This game is pretty skillful. There's no dice throwing.
I mean, the only luck would be the combination of scoring cards you get with your starter
deck.
Like
a killer synergy or something just randomly. But really, I mean, it's not much luck at all.
Right.
There's just a lot of deterministic, interesting play. Loved it. Solid 5. I think it's excellent. Look forward to playing it again. I think it's great.
Awesome.
Cool.
Well, the only thing I will say is I'm leading with it can get a little mean just because of the blowback I got from Jason from blowing up all his buildings. It still felt really good to do it. And I think it's kind of cool that that card's in the game.
I saw you grinning about it.
You were right to do it with the cards you got dealt.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it was a perfect confluence because it was in the second round, right? And people had seen that +3 card in the first round and it was like, okay, I'm going to the volcano. But I don't know. To me, it doesn't necessarily feel like a negative. And as you play it more and more, knowing that it's in there, I think it's kind of fun. It's like, okay, am I going to gamble or not? But you're right. That is a lot. It could be, it's like a coin toss, I guess, for the game that is, like you were saying, Chris, a very strategic game where there's no other luck other than did that card end up in somebody's hand and I don't know about it.
Right.
I like the fact that there's a lot of different places that you can get points. The only thing that I will call out that is a bit of a frustration was we had a couple games with people getting cut off in corners of the map, just not knowing that you could get cut off, that kind of jammed on their game for the rest of the game. I think in multiple iterations of the game, that kind of goes away because you kind of understand how the map plays. Right?
Yeah,
so
totally.
It's not really a big issue, but just something to think about. Anyway, I agree with what you said, Chris. I give it a 5-2 just because I think I would love to play it again now just because I think it's kind of cool. I like looking at what other people are doing and how that plays into, do I score mine? Do I play the others or whatever? Anyway, it's a cool game.
Yeah.
Did you give a rating?
Yeah, I said 5.
That's fine. Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah, I think you guys have summed it up pretty well. I don't know that I have a ton to add. The tension in this game is awesome. I was between a 4 and a 5 and I've been fluctuating throughout our review back and forth because I do think there are some things that make me take pause, and it's not necessarily the volcano thing. I think you made the right play, Bill, where that's concerned. I think I'm gonna land on a 5 because I think it's that good. Just the fact that there is very little luck, I don't know, there's something to that. That's like your destiny is your own. how well can you pay attention to what other people are doing
yeah.
and control it, right? I really enjoyed that, but there's still the variability of, like, the board is the same every time, but the placement of the tokens is different every time, and so it just changes the game each time. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this one. Give it a 5.
5, 5, 5.
Awesome.
That's shit, awesome.
It is. I wonder which game won that year at the Spiel.
It was, oh, gosh. 2012?
Hey,
Kingdom Builder.
Was it? Oh, well, okay. Ooh,
okay.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, so...
Kingdom Builder is better than this game.
Spoiler. Kingdom Builder is so good. Yeah. So if you're wondering, 5, 5, 5, that sounds pretty good. We need to do this. I'm going to take just a second. We're so bad about this. If we have new listeners or if they're new to the podcast, let me just quickly go over our scoring system because people might be like, is that a 5 out of 10? What does that mean? Real quick, because we never do this. But give a game a 1. I know the guys are annoyed that I'm doing this right now. It's for the listeners. If we give a game a 1. We think it's bad because we think that mechanically, from a design standpoint, something is wrong with the game. It's broken in some way from a mechanistic standpoint, and we think it's unplayable. 2, we also think it's bad, but it's not because we think there's something wrong with it from a design standpoint. We just don't like it. It's not fun. 3 is what we call the meh game. That's what we most of us game attribute. It's not bad, but it just doesn't really do anything for us. It's not exciting. We're not really looking to play it again. It's just meh. 4, that's a good game. That means we enjoyed it. If somebody was like, hey, let's play this game, we'd be like, yeah, I'll play that. I enjoy that game. It's fun. 5, excellent, above average. Really enjoyed the game, excited to teach it to other players. We think it's got a lot of value, and we want people to experience it. And then 6 is top-notch, some of our favorite games. We just think it's fantastic. That would be a 6. So we score on a 6-point scale here. Okay. Now that we got that out of the way.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah. Blah, blah, okay. How do you get this game? Well, there are no copies available at Noble Knight, unfortunately.
Great business model, guys.
Well, like I said, it's kind of a weird one. It's only German language. But there are 17 copies on BGG that are pretty affordable. So it's easy to get there. And like I said, it's language independent. If you get the rules on BGG in the file section, you should be able to play this game no problem. And I would recommend it. This game is cool, people. You check it out.
All right. Well, those are our thoughts on Santa Cruz.
Yes.
In ancient Greece, the cradle of European culture, Athens, Sparta, Corinth, and Thebes compete for dominance of the Greek peninsula and influence on Mount Olympus. The players work to lead their city-states to victory. Starting with a small village, each builds their town into a metropolis with oracles, temples, theaters, towers, and streets. They try to secure fruitful lands for themselves while hindering their opponents for the same. Players should watch their opponents carefully, as a single clever move can turn the promise of victory disappointing defeat. The excitement of a strategy game with a surprisingly simple game system. You go, girls. What? That's Attica.
You go, girls.
That's not part of it.
I was going for the guy in Aladdin. I couldn't quite get the low voice. His voice.
I didn't get that, but that was well done, Bill.
Wow, thank you. I was cueing the muses.
All right. Attica, also known as the game that almost destroyed Jason and I's friendship.
I'm guessing there's more on that later.
I couldn't help it. Oh, man, this is going to be a good one, folks. Just get ready. Oh, I'm going to try not to reopen too many old wounds here.
I'm going to have to do this whole podcast from outside this room, I think, if you're going to talk about
but
that.
But I'm feeling punchy right now. I'm not going to lie.
Not sure that was the game's fault.
All right.
Ouch.
Published in 2003 by Hans im Glück, Rio Grande Games, and 999 Games. At the time of this recording, its BGG ranking is 957. Uh-oh. Top 1,000 again. We've done it.
What are we doing?
I think this qualifies the forgotten category, though. Although this name did get reprinted as a game called U.S. Telegraph, but it didn't really take.
Really?
Yeah.
What was U.S. Telegraph?
It's like a more modern theme on the game.
So was it set in Greece?
No, it's like the old.
It's called U.S. Telegraph.
But it's like, wait a minute. How could it?
U.S. Okay. Telegraph.
Okay,
Bill.
I get it. All right. No, go ahead.
Gosh.
There's no Thebes in it, I guess.
No.
Okay.
All right. Again, designed by Marcel André Casasola Merkel, solo design. Brief rule summary for Attica. This is another weird one. I'll try to be brief, but it's kind of confusing. Not hard to play, but a little bit weird. Attica is an unusual pathway-creating game where the players can win in one of two ways. Either by connecting two shrines on the board by an uninterrupted line of their own building tiles, or by placing out all of their building tiles before the other players. The game board in Attica is randomly constructed of these hex-shaped pieces that are composed of seven smaller hexes. So a hex-shaped piece of hexes.
Hex right. of hexes.
A hex of hexes, as we like to say here on Hidden Gems. Importantly, some of these smaller hexes will have a printed resource type on them, while some of them will be blank. More on that later.
Multiple resource types.
Yeah, multiple different resource types, while some are blank. Additionally, once this modular board is constructed, a shrine piece is then placed on what equates to each corner of the board, so the shrines are basically equidistant from one another. Regarding each player's individual player area, each player will receive a player board and 30 round building tiles. These tiles demonstrate all of the different types of buildings a player can build and come in two types, main buildings and regular buildings. The six main buildings are shuffled and placed in a face-down stack, while the remaining 24 regular buildings are shuffled and placed into three face-down stacks of eight tiles each. The player's player board also has all of these different buildings pictured on it, and it shows the associations between the different types of buildings. So it's important to understand that what I mean by these associations is the buildings are kind of grouped into families, I guess, or kind of similar buildings. And there's one main building and then branching off in different ways, depending on the family of buildings, are the other buildings that kind of come off of these main buildings with arrows pointing to all these other regular buildings. I'll explain more why that's important.
What are you even talking about right now?
You know what I'm talking about.
Creating
the game.
Creating
Shut up, Jason.
Creating subcategories of buildings.
Don't worry, I'm going to edit out all the times you screwed up in Santa Cruz, okay? So people know. You're already starting. You're antagonizing me right now. At the start of the game, each player will draw the top building off of each of their four stacks of building tiles, placing them on their player board, and then they will draw a predetermined number of resource cards, which form their starting hand. On your turn, you can do one of two things. You can either draw two buildings, or you can build three buildings. When you draw buildings, you will randomly choose a building tile from one of your face-down stacks. Once drawn, you can either play the tile to the main game board, paying the associated costs, or you can place the building tile onto its corresponding spot on your player board, saving it to be built later. If you choose the build three buildings option, you will not be drawing any new building tiles, but instead you will be playing previously drawn building tiles from your player board onto the main game board. It's important to understand that when you build your buildings onto the main board, you can place them anywhere that you want. Okay, there are no restrictions associated with where you can place a building, and that every building has an associated cost, and they're all different. So, for example, let's consider the harbor. That takes three water resources and a tree resource. Okay, so that's the cost you have to pay. So you can pay that cost by placing the building tile onto or adjacent to resources of that type printed on the board. So for example, if I place that harbor tile next to two water icons, that pays for two of the three that I needed. So now I just need to come up with one more water and a tree resource. So where does that come from? Well, you can play the remainder with resource cards that have that resource type printed on them. Now, a couple of important details. Once you begin to start another group of buildings away from your first group, okay, so you start a new settlement. Let's say you start a second building not adjacent to your previously placed buildings. You can do that, but when you do that, that will cost you one extra resource card. And then when you do that again, if you choose to, you'll have to pay two extra cards, and so on for as many times as you choose to not build adjacent to previously placed buildings. That is important. Last thing. Why did I mention these families of buildings with all of these arrows coming off of the main buildings and how they're associated? Well, if you build a building onto the board, and then you have a building that's downstream from that building, so there's an arrow pointing to it, so it's kind of like the next logical progression of those type of buildings, you can place that building onto the board for free. It doesn't cost you anything. And then if there's another building downstream from that, you can place that one for free if and when you get it. Okay? Additionally, if you build the entire group or family of buildings onto the main game board and they are all touching, you will get something known as an amphora. An amphora can be played at any time on your turn, and it basically just gives you an extra action. You can use it to draw another building tile, to build an extra building, or to draw one extra resource card. Also, I didn't mention this before, but it should be noted, this is important, that you can gain more resource cards by foregoing tile draw or build actions on your turn in order to draw a resource card instead. So if I take the draw two action, I can draw one building tile, and then for my second draw, I can just take another card instead of drawing another tile. One final thing that needs to be mentioned is the game board expansion. This is also really important. If, on a player's turn, they empty one of their building tile stacks of tiles, they get to take one new face down game board piece, flip it face up, and then choose where to place it adjacent to the current board, thereby expanding the available area that players have to build upon. And again, that helps for getting your buildings built and can also really help you in making connections between shrines.
Or blocking.
Or blocking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we will get to. That's generally how you play Attica.
Good job, Chris.
Yeah, that was way better than Jason did on Santa Cruz.
Was it?
I don't know. Okay. They'll never know because I'll edit it beautifully. All right. So I think the obvious place to go here, and this isn't necessarily unique to Attica. There are other games that do this. Princes of Machu Picchu actually comes to mind. But games where you can win in one of two ways.
Mm-hmm.
And very kind of different ways, right? So you can either win by connecting those two shrines and the game just ends immediately. Or you can just place all your building tiles out. You can win that way as well. Not worrying about connections or not making connections. So how did you feel about the dual win condition? Did you feel like they were equally viable? Were they equally interesting? What did you think?
I think they're definitely equally interesting. I think it adds a good tension to the game. I have questions around whether they're equally viable.
Okay.
Mainly because I feel like most games that we've played of this, and I've played Attica many times.
Yeah, me too.
I've played it online.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's on Yukata, I think.
Yeah.
And I've played it live many times. I've seen very few games where it's ended by somebody placing all their tiles out.
Really? Okay.
Usually it seems to end because people connect temples together. But maybe that's...
There might be a reason why you see that in your games.
Whoa. All right. Just starting off right with that.
Shots
okay.
fired.
Cool. Yeah.
Got to be willing to block, you know? Uh-huh. We're just going for it.
This is so early.
I'm sorry. Keep going. I want to hear your thoughts. I'm just joking. I'm not joking, but I want to hear what you're saying.
Knives out.
Oh boy. Okay. I mean, ultimately though, I think that it adds a good tension because you're constantly weighing how can I be efficient versus when do I need to place tiles out, even if it's inefficient, in order to block, to prevent people from connecting the temples together. So I think that's a good tension point.
I'll agree. I feel like the game is kind of geared to the point of you must stop the direct route as much as you can and try to force the game to the 30th if you're not the person that's going to connect the two temples, right? Because that is really your initial goal for the game is you're trying to connect two temples, and that's kind of, I think of it as the Ender's Game thing, right? Where you're shooting for the goal. And
you have to do that to, at the very least, force other people to react.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So that is the mainstay of the game. The second one is kind of a secondary end game if everybody was really good at blocking people, right? Which is something you have to kind of keep in your back of your mind. I need to be clearing out my tiles if we end up to getting to that point. So to me, it's a little bit of a balance because you may need to make a choice in the later part of the game that says, I'm going to put a tile out here as part of my turn that is going to keep somebody else from winning that may not be getting some tiles off of my board.
Yes, and that's setting you back, right?
And it's setting you back.
If you're trying to rid yourself of tiles.
Exactly. Or right. You think that somebody else is going to. So it ends up being, like Jason, you're saying, a point of tension that you could conceivably lose the game because had to choose one over the other, right. I guess.
Yeah. Okay, so this is what I would say. I also have played this game numerous times. Easily 60, probably more, because there was a time where I was playing this on Yukata like daily. And I do feel that they are pretty equal, at least in my experience. I've seen people win many times getting their buildings out. I've seen people win many times making connections. The thing about this game is it just puts you in a bad spot, depending on what your strategy is, right? So if you're trying to make connections, that probably means that you're forgoing a lot of those free placements, right? Mm-hmm. You're kind of saying like, well, I could wait and hold this on my board and find its precursor so that I can then place them with this one out later for free and I'm being more efficient. But if somebody at the table is just saying like, screw it, I'm going to place this building down, pay for it to get one step closer to making a connection, now I am putting the burden on you to play in a blocking fashion that is not convenient for you. It's not where you're wanting to go, but I'm forcing you to do something you necessarily don't want to do because I'm threatening to win the game.
Right.
And so now I'm taking you out of the style of play that maybe you're trying to play, right? But if the people at the table are being really aggressive about blocking, you might find yourself in a bind and not be able to make connections. You might be behind in getting your buildings built. But that also comes at a cost to them. So I guess that's the point I'm making is I think they're both kind of equal because they both come at a cost, if that makes sense. It's hard to explain, but I think it works out. And I find it very interesting, to be quite honest.
Pushing in one direction forces an equal and opposite reaction. If players are playing optimally, that pulls back that option from being as viable as it otherwise would be.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Another thing that I found really interesting in this game is the tension between do I try to pull a lot of tiles out of my stacks to get that synergy of the free builds versus do I jump on the board and try to take spots to secure locations, right?
Yeah, because exactly. If
you even subtracting out the whole connecting temples thing, you're incentivized to connect buildings together in such a way that you can get the amphora because those can be huge in terms of making a final go at the end game. But you only get those if you manage to take an entire grouping of tiles and get them on the board all adjacent to each other.
Yeah. Right.
That's hard to do
yep.
because people are constantly crowding your space.
Yes.
So you're always in this tension of, do I try to just keep pulling tiles from my stacks so that I can get an entire like tree ready to go
right.
so I can just dump it out on the board and get it into position? Or do I grab that spot that I really need so that Bill doesn't take it and block me off so that I don't like have space to actually get all the tiles out on the board that I need to get on the board? I think that's a crazy tension that's added into this. In addition to, you're also thinking about, well, I need to connect this one shrine to this other shrine.
Right, if that's even something you're trying to do. I'd like to hear right. Bill's thoughts on this because it struck me when we played it the first time because I think this is a thought everybody has. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, Bill, if you have any. I could tell you were thinking, well, why wouldn't I just draw, you know, and get a lot of connections to where I can just make a lot of free placements? That would make a lot of sense, right? But
right.
if you're drawing a lot and not playing on the board to try to get those efficient free connections, you just see those board spaces getting snatched up.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. Everybody's grabbing the prime real estate. Not to mention the fact, then you start to see, well, if I don't play something, this guy's going to connect and the game's just going to be over.
Right.
And so it puts you in a tough spot, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're like, well, I'd like to get as many freebies as I can, but I'm kind of being compelled to play here.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting tension that I really enjoy about this game.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny because the first game that I played, it was kind of funny. You're ignoring the new guy because this truly was the first time I'd ever played. I ended up making a beeline towards the temple, and I think I was lucky enough to draw the streets, which I didn't know how lucky I was, but I was able to finish four tiles in the round and connect super fast. I mean, that game was over in, you know, 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that. The second round, I had the idea of, yes, let me try to create that synergy. Let me collect my tiles before I start dropping. and it was kind of a slow dawning that's like, okay, everybody's blocking my path now.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I learned is managing when you empty a stack, right? Because that is super important. Because the first time I was just emptying a stack and I would lay one of the large hex tiles down kind of early in the game. But that's another management thing that you have to think about, is you may want to choose pulling your tiles from other stacks and then pulling out the large hex tiles at the end of the game, either to block somebody else or to give you an avenue to win, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, I want to say a quick word about this as well, because I'm glad you mentioned this. I think this is so interesting. So when you draw these tiles, making a connection on the board at its base state is nearly impossible, because it just gets so crowded so fast.
Right.
But what's so cool about this game is when you empty one of your stacks, or anybody does, they're adding to the tile area around the edge of the board, whereby now you can get around blockades, basically, and now the threat of a connection becomes real again, right?
Right.
And it's very real. It can be very threatening. But what's clever, and I think you alluded to this, is you can place the tiles in such a way to where it actually will hinder somebody from making a connection, because you can place the tile in a really wonky way. But what I love about that is that while you are hindering an opponent, you're also hurting yourself in a way and helping them in another way. And that tile that you just placed, although it's placed weirdly and not helpful for connections, has resources on it.
Right.
So it would be better for you if you could place that tile next to you and continue to expand.
Right.
But if you place it next to them to block them, you may have mucked up their connection or made it harder for them. But now you've just put a whole bunch of resources next to them they can build on.
Right.
So there's like a trade-off there.
And if you don't place the tile there to block them, they're going to place the tile there that's like optimal.
And then try to connect.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's definitely a learning curve on when you do that, because this is the knives out portion of the section. Is you need to have everybody at the table kind of in sync on realizing when somebody's in the striking distance of winning, because they need to place that tile to keep somebody from doing it or do the blocking action, because that's a big part of this game, is everybody needs to be board aware at the, at the end game, which is crazy.
Yeah, we need to. We need to talk about that.
All right, cough head. What do you think?
Derailed by the fact that I can't breathe right now.
Sorry about Jason's coughing. He's sick. It's okay. It's not his fault.
Yeah, no.
I'm not going to be able to edit out all that. Are you good?
No, I'm not. Okay. But
is it all right if I start talking about what a jerk you are?
What a jerk I am. Good grief. I feel like we're going to have to sort this out.
Okay, let's sort it out. This might be therapeutic for us. Okay. All right. So piggybacking off of what Bill just said, it's so important to understand this about this game. There is definitely a component of this game where you're constantly keeping an eye on your competitors, and especially in a three-player game, the game will alternate between somebody looking like they're threatening and the other two players having to stop them. And then it might be Jason who's threatening, and then Bill and I need to figure out a way to stop him, right? And so that can lead to some spirited negotiations about what is the best path forward. So I will explain what happened. This is me admitting that I was probably being a little too heavy-handed here, okay? All right. So as Bill mentioned, the first time we played this, Jason and I played this 50 times each. Bill never played it. We're like, oh, Bill, it's okay, you're probably not going to win, but, you know, just watch us and you'll figure it out. Bill freaking won, okay?
I did.
So I was, like, already, like, hyper-sensitive to Bill winning the next game, right? And then the second game...
Because I was so graceful at winning the first
game. To be fair, I hadn't played the game in a very, very long time, and so I'd forgotten some of the main strategies. And, on top of that, had terrible tile draws to be able to actually do what needed to be done to prevent him from doing what he did.
I'm not blaming you for that.
No, I'm just filling in. Yeah. I'm filling in context here.
I'm just saying that we were stunned and weren't paying attention. So we were already, or at least I was already kind of like,
Bill won a game.
What I'm hearing is it was pure genius at play here.
So I was like, Bill's not winning again. All right. So in the second game, Bill was threatening to win again by connection. And I was like, okay, Jason, we got to do something here. And I was like, what if you did this? What if you did this? Jason didn't like the suggestions I was making, which is fine. So Jason kind of made like, you feel free to tell your version of the story. I want you to. I think it's good for the podcast. Made kind of like a, you know, this anemic type of blocking move, right?
Good for our podcast in that we still have a relationship after recording this episode.
A real wimpy block that Bill could go around. And I like placed a new settlement in the way, right? I just plopped it in the way at cost to me to at least hinder him a little bit. Next turn or two turns later, there was like a golden opportunity for Jason. It would have come at cost to Jason to drop a tile that would have really just fussed you up for connections. And we didn't see eye to eye on that. That's all I'll say about it. I'll let Jason fill in the details. The point I'm making is, regardless of whether I was right about it or Jason was right about it, you can definitely find in this game that you could get into arguments or disagreements with your opponents about how to stop your opponent. Mm-hmm. Because nobody wants to do it because it's not expedient to do it, right? And I will also say, and this isn't true of Jason, I'm just saying that this is something you should know. If you're playing this game with somebody who is just going to be like, I'm not blocking, y'all figure it out, and that's always their approach, this game will not work well. I'm not saying that is what Jason did. I'm just saying you have to understand that there's this kind of synergistic blocking that goes on, and it can lead to a lot of arguments. All right, Jason, go ahead.
No, I want to go ahead. So Jason just wasn't as smart as Chris.
That's not what seeing... right, tell me all the, tell our listeners all the awful things I said to you because you wouldn't do what I told you should do.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Just do it.
No. Where to start here?
That well is so deep and so wide.
No, so a couple things. So first, I do think there is room in this game to put pressure on... I'm not saying that this directly applies to this particular situation, but there is definitely room in this game to put pressure on the people in turn order after you to deal with the situation.
Yeah.
Right? To be like... Well, I'm not going to deal with it, therefore you need to deal with it. You do the inefficient play, if you're that concerned about it, in order to block. Because I'm in turn order ahead of you, and I have that advantage, right? That happens in a lot of different games, and I think that applies here. I don't know that that directly applies in the particular situation we're talking about. Because there will be situations where one person in and of themselves cannot do what needs to be done in order to block. So it has to be a team effort.
Sure.
That inherently creates the situation that you're talking about, which is that it's going to create arguments and disagreements. That said, I don't know how deep we want to go into this on this podcast, but I think what happened in that scenario was that you took it from a position of this is what needs to happen in order to block Bill to it's entirely your fault if Bill wins this game if you don't do this.
I will interject at this point. I was concerned about what I was going to have to tell the police when they arrived.
Bill was just sitting across the table with like his eyes were as big as saucers, and he was just watching me and Jason as I was accosting him. Jason was getting mad at me because I was telling him what, you know, I thought we should do in the moment.
No. You weren't telling me what you thought we should do in the moment. You were telling me that it was going to be entirely my fault if Bill won the game.
It would have been.
Because... No.
You were not doing what was necessary.
We can't let that happen twice in a night, Jason.
Oh, goodness. I think the moral of the story here is that ultimately we're playing board games. Right? We're playing games with a bunch of cardboard on a table. And this is getting outside of the context of a review here. But I think that if any game gets us to the point where we're willing to get into a disagreement and a legitimate argument about whether somebody's doing the right move or the wrong move, like whether they're doing the right move or the wrong move or not, right? And I'm guilty of this too. I'm not placing this on you. I'm guilty of this too. Like if we get to the point where that has become the central position of a gameplay, then we're missing the point of playing right. A game and having fun. Because we've gone from playing a game to have fun to playing a game to win or to prove that we know the best way to play it. And I'm not saying that I was right in that situation. There were probably better ways that I could have played in that scenario that would have prevented Bill from winning. And I don't even think Bill won that game. You won that game.
I did.
That goes to my...
But Bill could have won it.
That goes to my second point.
Bill could have won. That's what... It was close.
Yeah, Bill could have won. Yeah.
No.
That, I think that goes to my second point, which is that I think metagaming comes into play in these scenarios too, right? Which is, yeah, there was an optimal move for me to make, but that optimal move was at my detriment to your benefit, no, right?
Yes, but can I just interject real quick? The turn before that, I had taken a suboptimal move to block Bill, and then I was expecting you to reciprocate, and you wouldn't do it. That's why I got mad.
Sure. I think what I'm saying is, like, that's where meta comes into the gameplay, right? Of, like, well, if in my mind I'm like, well, yeah, sure, Chris thinks this is the best play to make because look how it benefits him. And, like, ultimately you won the game, right? That type of stuff can come into any play of any game, is a narrative or whatever in somebody's head, like, across, like, even across plays of games, right? Like, and I'm getting real about, you know, how things happen, right?
Yeah, so for sure.
I think there's more nuance to this than just, like, the dynamics of how Attica plays, right? Like, I think Attica brought things to the surface for us that that maybe go beyond the mechanics of this particular game. But I guess the ultimate conclusion of all of this is that this can create these situations, so just beware.
It's right? True.
But I think that we can't take any game so seriously that, like, anybody not playing in a particular way detracts from the experience of the game. And I'm guilty of that as much as anybody. So, I don't know. That's my thoughts.
That's fair. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can I just say one more thing so that our listeners don't think I'm a terrible person? I am. I'm horrible. I shouldn't have any friends.
That's not what I said.
I know you that? Didn't. I'm filling in the gaps.
I wouldn't say I'm here because Talia pays me. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say I feel like that when we were having that banter, I wasn't coming across this way, but in my mind, I felt like it was a jovial banter. I don't feel like I was accosting Jason, but I think that I came across that way to him. And so I think you do have to be careful in games like this about this has turned into a backstage episode. I'm sorry, folks.
But we can edit this all
this
out.
This is a good discussion. No, I'm going to leave it. I think it's fun to do something different. I think this whole discussion, even though we're not talking a lot about the mechanics of the game, will give you an idea about what to expect in this game.
I think if you've been in a game group for any length of time, it's probably relevant to some thought process you've had in your mind about playing against somebody else at some point.
Everybody's been here if you've been playing games for any sort of time.
Right.
Bill, what do you think about all this? Do we need therapy? Did Jason and I need couples therapy?
Of course you do. And I'm here to listen. I'll tell you what my billing is later. I think it's funny sometimes just the energy in the air sometimes when you come together with a group. Because I think on another night, nothing like this would have happened. I think, what you thought you were projecting, Chris, with the positive banter, Jason would have accepted it as the same thing. Because we've played many games and in many more nights, I'd probably say 9 out of 10 would have been taken that way. But sometimes something's in the air in the night where people are on edge, whether it's the stress in your house, whether it's, you know, the what's going on in your house, Jason, or whatever. The people are just not necessarily receptive to being coaxed in the middle of the game. And the way that Chris has two superpowers. He can explain games really well, and then he can also make you feel guilty as hell as you're playing a game that you're not doing what you should be doing. That's Chris's mind.
Always to my benefit.
Always to his benefit.
Exactly.
And so he was using that in full force, and Jason was not saying, I'm taking it tonight. And so, yeah, there was a lot of things at play at that point in the night.
Oh, man.
How many minutes have we spent talking about this?
Sorry. I don't know if that was fair or not, but you know.
No. I'm glad you interjected.
This was good. I think we should. You want to wrap it up, and then any like really, really big points you want to make, and just briefly mention in your final thoughts. What do you think?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we've hit the main points for sure. All right, Bill. Or wait, yeah, Bill, you're up.
I get to go.
You're first. Yeah.
So it's funny. I had no idea that you guys had played this game as many times as you had. When you were talking about
it 60 times.
It sounds like a lot, but I mean, I do think this is a game that you need to play multiple times because, like we've just been talking about, when you get to that end game where somebody could potentially win, really, I mean, my point of view is this game is all about prolonging it to the point so you do end with whoever ends up with the tiles out, right? Because you're absolutely trying to stop somebody from getting that straight line temple-to-temple connection. And if you don't do that, then, I don't know, somebody's played super well or you just haven't coordinated well, I guess.
It can be hard to stop sometimes.
It can be. It can be. So they just got the right tiles. They just played well, mm-hmm. right? Especially with, what are the ones where you get extra turns?
The amphoras.
The amphoras, yeah.
I'm going to mention that.
Yeah, because Chris was a master at playing the amphoras.
They're
at the end.
Critical, yeah.
Right, exactly, for the coup de grace at the end. And so, you know, for me, I kind of want to play it again. More just because I started getting a glimpse into how that works at the end. Also, how to manage the Hex of Hexes plays to prevent people from winning. And I think there's just there's a lot to this game that I feel like multiple plays would reveal to me. So I'm going to give this one also a 5 just because I think it's, nice. It's super cool. Glad to hear that there's an online version and I want to play it.
It's a good one too.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of fun. So anyway, this is again another kudos. This is another, you know, I'm glad he, you know, who won the Spiel this year?
I know, right? So, I don't know. This is 2003.
This was a nominee?
I think it was.
Yeah, I think you said it was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'll give it another 5.
All right. Well, yeah, I echo what Bill says. There is tension all through this game.
Oh, my.
If it hasn't been apparent. between the mechanics and Chris and I's, you know, therapy session during this discussion, there is tension all throughout this. From what tiles do I draw? When do I draw them? When do I place them out? Where do I place them out? Where do I place my hexes of hexes, right? So many things to think about. For an abstract game, right? This is very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so much to think about. This game is top-notch
in
my book. Despite all of our arguments, I gave this game a 6 easily. Right?
Wow.
This game is phenomenal. Every time I've played it, so much tension, so many things to think about, so many different paths to go down.
Yeah.
But enough randomness built into it that every game is different.
Yep.
Because you're not going to get the same tiles in the same order. You're not going to be able to predict what combinations of free builds you're going to get. And how that's all going to play out. I don't really know how to explain it better than that. But it's, there's just perfect tension all throughout every decision in this game. And it's easily a 6 for me.
So I have a quick question. It's a generic 6. What is it with Chris at the table?
Still a 6.
Played online with you on Yukata, it's a 6 for sure.
It's just some playful banter.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Okay, Chris, what do you think?
Stop being so sensitive. All right. All right. So interestingly, about this episode, we originally were going to be reviewing Mortarer. And I was struggling learning that game because it's super complicated for a card game. The rules are a little rough. And then Jason happened to look at my shelf, and he was like, hey, Attica. This guy designed Attica, too. And I was like, dang it. Yeah, he did. And the reason I thought, dang it, is because I knew before we even played it together, I was going to give it a 6. And everybody thinks I'm the 6 guy. And I was like, oh, dang it. I'm going to have to give out another 6.
Wow.
Because this game is freaking awesome. This game is so fun. I love this game. Every time I play it, like I said, I played it easily 50 times on Yukata, at least. Because for all the reasons Jason just said, there is so much tension and the decision points are numerous and they're subtle. Like when I build 3, do I just build 1 and draw 2 cards? Do I draw 1 card? Do I draw no cards? Do I place here? Do I start a second settlement? Do I start a third settlement? Do I block? Do I try to keep together and get my buildings out? Oh my gosh. People, this game is so good. I totally agree with Jason. Super fun. And as Bill alluded to, you can make some really killer surgical strikes with these amphoras. They give you those extra turns where you can be on the doorstep and you can just bang, 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 make a connection and close the game out when it looks like you're going to lose.
But that's not a given. It takes a lot of planning to do that.
You do. You have to set it up, and you can lose in the interim trying to set up for that if you know you're not going to go out before somebody else from a building standpoint. Just know, if it's not been made clear enough already, that again, the game can get sharp from a relational standpoint when you feel like that you think that you know what somebody should do and they disagree with you, and that's fine.
There needs to be a term for a game like this where the interdependency causes people to have to keep other players in check. Right. That's basically what it is. Yes. Right? If a player gets out into the lead, the other players need to collectively work together to keep them in check.
Not only that, but the experience level of all the people playing. If there's all three of us playing and there's one, like you brought the super noob in here, me, right, in there, that they could be a real detriment to the game, right? Because they could really kind of wreck the experience in a way.
If one person doesn't understand or see the threat.
Right. Yes, exactly.
That can...
And I've heard that criticism about this game, and I'll reiterate it again. I'm not saying that about anybody at this table, but if you were playing the game with somebody who everybody else, let's say you're playing a four-player game, the other two people are like, hey, man, you got to do this, because if you don't, and that person is just like, nah, I'm just going to keep doing what's good for me.
Right.
That could get really annoying in this game.
Right.
And if you have somebody like that in your group, this game will not work.
Right.
But if everybody is committed to at least trying to do their part to stop the other players, it just becomes a vicious knife fight in the best way possible, to be quite honest. It's just, it's stellar.
That one game that you won, that was a learning experience to me at the end of the game, that knowing that you had the amphora, I didn't realize that you could get as far as you could. And so that, you know, now the next game that I play, I know to play defensively. To stop what you were able to do. Yeah, so
especially if you've got two of them.
Oh, yeah.
You can, if you draw the right cards, or if you have the cards in your hand, you can really just out of the blue be like, whoa, and just grab it.
Bam, bam.
Yeah, bam, bam, bam. Yeah. Mm.
Cool.
Good stuff. I love you, Jason. You're one of my besties. All right, where can we get this crazy freaking game? Well... there are no copies at Noble Knight, unfortunately. However, there are 45 copies on the BGG Marketplace for pretty cheap. Easy to get this game.
What about U.S. Telegraph?
And U.S. Telegraph is also available on BGG pretty readily. However, they made a couple of changes to U.S. Telegraph. The biggest one being that your buildings don't all need to be connected in a family to get amphoras.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
No.
Yeah.
Gross.
Let's just take an awesome game and eliminate a tension point. No. Not to mention, the theme is just cooler in Attica, I think. Yeah. You don't need this. Don't get U.S. Telegraph. Don't do it.
Yeah, get Attica. Roman themes are overdone, but in this game, it makes sense.
Totally works. Yeah. It's superior. It's fun.
Awesome.
Check it out.
And those are our thoughts on Attica.
Nice.
Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Hidden Gems. If you like what we're doing here, please remember that it's a huge help to us to give us a rating or review on your favorite podcast platform of choice, or follow us on one of our many social media platforms. Check out the BGG Guild if you want to interact with us, or share a game that you feel is a hidden gem, or check us out on Discord. And if you're so inclined, please consider supporting the show over on our Patreon at patreon.com/hiddengemspodcast. Till next time, I'm your host, Jason.
This is Chris.
And this is Bill.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Hidden Gems, number 54, was recorded in Raleigh, North Carolina on September 13th, 2023. Did you enjoy today's designer spotlight on Marcel André Casasola Merkel? We hope that you did, and if so, please join us again in 3 weeks as we do yet another spotlight feature episode, this time not on a designer, but on a publishing company. One of the founding pillars of the board game hobby, Zach Verlag. Hidden Gems is produced and edited by Chris Alley, Cameron Lockie, and Jason Yanchilev. Our Board Game Geek Guild is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Ghidorah. Our Discord channel is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Snoozefest. Our show's logo was illustrated by designer and artist Caitlin Nieto. Check out her work on Instagram at @itscaitlinnieto. We would love to hear from you. Feel free to join the discussion on our many social media accounts. You can find us on Facebook at Hidden Gems Board Game Podcast, Instagram at HiddenGems.podcast, and Twitter at Hidden Gems Board. Disagree with one of our reviews? Have something you want to say about one of the games we discussed today? You can also make your voice heard on our Board Game Geek Guild at BoardGameGeek.com, Guild number 3874. Once again, thank you for joining us on Hidden Gems, and until next time, fellow gem seekers, enjoy your games, enjoy your search.